obligations. They were not close to Lewis, they were much less interested in the West than Jefferson, and they did not approve of Lewis's free and easy way of signing drafts. They agreed with a former Indian agent who wrote to President Madison to protest the contract, asking, "Is it proper for the public service that the U.S. officers, as a governor or a superintendent of Indian affairs, should take any share in mercantile and private concerns?" Secretary Bates was raising the same question, and he was furious that Lewis, expected to leave for Washington shortly, had named Clark rather than himself as his agent. Further, Bates was in continual disagreement with the governor over policy matters. Lewis was interested in promoting the fur trade. Bates wanted to promote settlement. Lewis refused to issue licenses for hunters in Indian country. Bates thought it a right of Americans to hunt. So angry was Bates that in mid-April he said publicly that he had decided to write the president a catalog of his complaints. But before he could do so, he had an altercation with Lewis. He spoke to Lewis with an extreme freedom of the wrongs Lewis had done him. In an April 15th letter to his brother, Bates explained that Lewis had aroused my indignation and caused a heated resentment. What the specific issue was, he didn't say. Probably it was Clark's appointment as Lewis's agent. "We now understand each other much better," Bates wrote. "We differ in everything, but we will be honest and frank in our intercourse." Bates was an unlikable character, that type of bureaucrat who cannot for the life of him see any other person's point of view. In a letter to his brother, he confessed that he found this a strange world. He explained, "My habits are pacific, yet I have had acrimonious differences with almost every person with whom I have been associated in public business." He admitted that this disturbed him and had caused him to examine his actions, but, "Before God, I cannot acknowledge that I have been blamable in any one instance." His jealousy of Lewis was obvious. He told his brother that Lewis has been spoiled by the elegant praises of scientists and poets, and overwhelmed by so many flattering caresses of the high and mighty that, like an overgrown baby, he begins to think that everybody about the house must regulate their conduct by his caprices. It was commonly said in St. Louis that Bates wanted Lewis's job. In his April 15th letter, Bates charged that Lewis had lost public confidence. "I lament the unpopularity of the governor," he claimed, "but he has brought it on himself by harsh and mistaken measures. He is inflexible in error, and the irresistible fiat of the people has, I am fearful, already sealed his condemnation. Burn this letter." Through the late winter and into the spring of 1809, the Missouri River Fur Company recruited men and gathered supplies. Word came downriver that the Sioux had joined the Arikaras and were determined to stop all boats headed upstream. Lewis looked over the supply of presents for the Indians and decided it was insufficient. So on March 7th, he signed a draft payable to Pierre Chouteau for $1,500 for additional presents. On May 13th, he signed another for $500, and 2 days later, yet another in the amount of $450, mainly for 500 pounds of gunpowder and 1,250 pounds of lead. Meanwhile, he worked on a set of orders for Chouteau. He declared that Chouteau's principal object was to return Big White and his family. Paraphrasing what Jefferson had told him, Lewis wrote, "I consider the honor and good faith of our government pledged for the success of this enterprise." Lewis avoided specifics. "I deem it improper to trammel your operations by detailed and positive commands as to the plan of procedure." But he had suggestions. The first was to employ up to 300 Indians from the nations living below the Arikaras. "You will promise them, as a reward for their services, the plunder which they may acquire from the Arikaras." He further advised Chouteau to recruit 100 white hunters and trappers, bringing his total up to 250 whites and 300 Indians. In other words, should the Arikaras prove still to be hostile, Lewis was declaring all-out war on them. He was explicit on the point. He wanted Chouteau to have a force sufficient not only to bid defiance to the Arikaras, but to extirpate that abandoned nation if necessary. This went far beyond Jefferson's recommendation that if the Arikaras tried to stop Big White, they should be punished. It went far beyond burning their property or killing their horses. It called for nothing short of genocide. If the Arikaras proved to be peaceable, Shuto should demand of them the unconditional surrender of the warriors who had killed any member of Ensign Pryor's party. Should the Arikaras claim they could not say who had fired the fatal bullets, Shuto should require them to deliver up three warriors, three white men had been killed, chosen from among those most active in stimulating the hostilities. These murderers, when delivered, will be shot in the presence of the nation, and the Arikaras required to give their horses to Shuto's Indian allies. If the Arikaras refuse to deliver up their warriors, you will take such measures as you may think best calculated to surprise and cut them off. If Shuto took any prisoners, you will either give them to the Mandan or Minotaur nations. If the expeditions got into an inconclusive fight and passed the Arikaras without destroying them, Shuto should make an alliance with the Mandans and supply them with the necessary firepower to crush the Arikaras. Lewis also said that Shuto would be meeting with sundry American citizens whose licenses to trade on the Missouri had expired. If they had acted in good faith, Shuto should renew their licenses. Had their conduct been improper, he should arrest them and return them to St. Louis by force. As for the competition from the North, no British agent, clerk, or engagé can under any pretense whatever be permitted to trade or hunt within this territory, the limits of which are to be conceived to extend to all that country watered by the Missouri. Lewis signed off, "I sincerely wish you a pleasant voyage and a safe return to your family and friends." In mid-May, the expedition was underway. Altogether, there were 13 keelboats and barges, the largest flotilla sent up the river to date. Through June and into July, rumors floated around St. Louis about Bates. He had made it known that he intended to denounce Lewis to the president and was said to be at the head of a party whose object it would be to procure his dismissal. So widespread was the talk that Lewis called on Bates to demand an explanation. "You are greatly mistaken," Bates told him. In a letter of July 14th to his brother, Bates related that, "As a citizen, I told him I entertained opinions very different from his on the subject of civil government, and that those opinions had, on various occasions, been expressed with emphasis, but that they had been unmixed with personal malice or hostility." "Well," Lewis replied, "do not suffer yourself to be separated from me in the public opinion. When we meet in public, let us at least address each other with cordiality." Bates agreed, though he complained to his brother that Lewis had used me badly. Then Bates demanded that Clark be brought into the conversation to settle the business about Lewis's appointment of Clark as his agent. When Clark arrived, Bates told the two men that the laws expressly provided that he, Secretary Bates, should be the governor's agent when the governor was traveling. "I will suffer no interferences, etc., etc., etc.," he declared. To his brother, Bates remarked, "How unfortunate for this man, Lewis, that he resigned his commission in the army. His habits are altogether military, and he never can, I think, succeed in any other profession." On July 16th, Bates wrote the Secretary of the Treasury to complain about Lewis's behavior. It seemed Lewis had ordered Bates to print the laws of the territory and charge it to the Secretary's office. Bates had refused, but ultimately relented in response to Lewis's repeated order. Now he wanted the Treasury to compensate him. By July 25th, Bates was able to boast to an ally, "Our Governor Lewis, with the best intentions in the world, is, I am fearful, losing ground. He has talked for these 12 months of leaving the country. Everybody thinks now that he will positively go in a few weeks." In early August, Lewis received a short note from a clerk in the Department of State named R.S. Smith. It referred to a draft Lewis had signed on February 10th in favor of one Peter Provencher for $18.50 for translating the laws of the territory into French for publication. Although Lewis had no authorization to pay for such services, he explained, "I did not hesitate to cause the copies of those laws to be made out for a felony trial. I was compelled to take the course which I have, or suffer a fellow to escape punishment." Now the bill came back to him with a note from Clerk Smith. "The bill mentioned in this letter, having been drawn without authority, it cannot be paid at this department." Lewis was shaken by the refusal. This occurrence has given me infinite concern, as from it the fate of other bills, drawn for similar purposes, to a considerable amount, cannot be mistaken, he wrote. This rejection cannot fail to impress the public mind unfavorably with respect to me, nor is this consideration more painful than the censure which must arise in the mind of the executive from my having drawn public monies without authority. A third and not less embarrassing circumstance attending the transaction is that my private funds are entirely incompetent to meet these bills, if protested. Secretary Bates thought of himself as a long-suffering, honest, misunderstood man guarding the public treasury. He sent a series of complaints about Lewis's drafts and orders to Washington. Sometime that summer, Lewis struck back. As Bates put it, he took it into his head to disavow certain statements which I had made, by his order, from the Secretary's office. This was too much. I waited on him, told him my wrongs, that I could not bear to be treated in such a manner. Take your own course, Lewis replied. I shall, sir, Bates fired back. And I shall come in future to the executive office when I have business at it. Shortly thereafter, a ball was held in St. Louis. Bates was present when Lewis entered. Bates recorded, he drew his chair close to mine. There was a pause in the conversation. I availed myself of it, arose, and walked to the opposite side of the room. Lewis also rose, according to Bates, evidently in passion. Lewis retired into an adjoining room and sent a servant for Clark. He told Clark that Bates had treated him with contempt and insult and that he could not suffer it to pass. He asked him to call Bates into the room. Clark refused, according to Bates, because he foresaw that a battle must have been the consequence of our meeting. Some days later, Clark called on Bates to ask that he patch things up with Lewis. No, Bates replied. The governor has told me to take my own course, and I shall step a high and a proud path. He has injured me, and he must undo that injury. You come, Bates told Clark, as my friend, but I cannot separate you from Governor Lewis. You have trodden the ups and the downs of life with him, and it appears to me that these proposals are made solely for his convenience. This unseemly squabbling certainly did Lewis's mood no good, but it was a minor affair compared with what happened to him on August 18th. That day, he received a heart-stopping letter from Secretary of War Eustace. Dated July 19th, it was written in the deadly passive voice of the born bureaucrat. Eustace said that, after his department had reluctantly approved Lewis's contract with the Missouri River Fur Company for $7,000, it was not expected that any further advances or any further agency would be required on the part of the United States. Lewis should, therefore, not be surprised that his draft of May 13th for an additional $500 for presents for the Indians has not been honored. That meant Lewis was personally responsible for the money. Eustace went on, it has been usual to advise the government of the United States when expenditures to a considerable amount are contemplated in the territorial government. When 125 men are to be enlisted for a military expedition to a point and purpose not designated, which expedition is stated to combine commercial as well as military objects, it is thought the government might, without injury to the public interests, have been consulted. In fact, Lewis had been explicit about the purpose of the expedition, although he had not cleared the commercial aspects of it with Washington. Eustace seized on that point. As the object and destination of this force, beyond the Mandans, is unknown, and more especially as it combines commercial purposes, so it cannot be considered as having the sanction of the government of the United States, or that they are responsible for consequences. Eustace closed with a chilling remark. The President has been consulted, and the observations herein contained have his approval. The President, of course, was Madison, not Jefferson, now retired at Monticello and unable to protect Lewis. In any event, Jefferson was unhappy with Lewis. He was slow to censure and ready to give Lewis the benefit of the doubt, but his patience was wearing thin. On August 16th, he sent Lewis a letter of introduction for an English botanist coming to St. Louis on a botanizing tour. Then Jefferson wrote, I am very often applied to know when your work will begin to appear, and I have so long promised copies to my literary correspondents in France that I am almost bankrupt in their eyes. I shall be very happy to receive from yourself information of your expectations on this subject. Everybody is impatient for it." Perhaps to soften the blow, Jefferson added some political gossip and commentary on foreign affairs. He said Lewis's friends in Virginia are well and have been long in expectation of seeing you. I shall hope in that case to possess a due portion of you at Monticello, where I am at length enjoying the never-before-known luxury of employing myself for my own gratification only. He asked Lewis to present his best wishes to Clark, and be assured yourself of my constant and unalterable affections. Lewis never replied or made any known mention of the letter, nor did he explain to anyone, even Clark, the cause of the delay in preparing the journals for publication. Lewis did reply to Eustace in a letter of August 18th, the day he got it. He said Eustace's letter of July 19th is now before me. The feelings it excites are truly painful. He protested that he had accompanied every draft for a public expenditure with an explicit statement of the purpose and insisted, "I have never received a penny of public money." He added, "To the correctness of this statement, I call my God to witness. I have been informed representations have been made against me," Lewis went on. What those representations might have been is not known, but can be surmised from his protests against them. Nor is the source known, but it can be guessed that it was Bates. Evidently, Bates, or someone else, had spread a story that the Missouri River Fur Company intended to go into the Rocky Mountains, beyond the Continental Divide, into territory not belonging to the United States, possibly with the intent of setting up a new country, a la Aaron Burr and General Wilkinson. Whatever the specifics, Lewis said he could not correct by letter the impressions which I fear from the tenor of your letter the government entertain with respect to me. Therefore, he would leave St. Louis in a week, going by way of New Orleans to Washington. "I shall take with me my papers, which I trust when examined will prove my firm and steady attachment to my country." The expedition to return Big White had only that object, he went on, "and in a commercial point of view, they, the company, intend only to hunt and trade on the waters of the Missouri and Columbia rivers within the Rocky Mountains and the plains bordering those mountains on the east side, and that they have no intention with which I am acquainted to enter the dominions or do injury to any foreign power. Be assured, sir, that my country can never make a burr of me. She may reduce me to poverty, but she can never sever my attachment from her." Word that the government had refused to honor Lewis's drafts had spread round town within hours of the arrival of Eustace's letter. Bates again. Lewis informed Eustace that the protested bills have effectually sunk my credit, brought in all my private debts amounting to about $4,000. He had handed over to his creditors the deeds to the land he had purchased around St. Louis as security, and pointed out that "the best proof which I can give of my integrity as to the use or expenditure of the public monies, the government will find at a future day by the poverty to which they have now reduced me." Lewis spent the next few days with Clark. They agreed that both of them should go to Washington. Clark was, of course, deeply involved in the Missouri River Fur Company, and in any case had other governmental matters to take up with the War Department, including protested drafts of his brother George Rogers Clark, which had ruined him. Lewis would go by water, Clark over land. They spent much time attempting to put Lewis's accounts in order. They made up a list of what Lewis owed. It came to some $2,900, exclusive of his land debts. Lewis sent ahead to New Orleans the land warrant for 1,600 acres he had been given by Congress, to be sold, he hoped, for $2 an acre. He wanted the money deposited in a New Orleans bank for the benefit of my creditors. He returned to Auguste Chouteau much of the land he had bought from him on credit. He looked around for anything he had that could be sold. In Clark's memorandum book, Lewis wrote, "The Negro boy Tom belongs to my mother and therefore cannot be sold on my account." The most valuable item he possessed by far was the journals, worth 1,000 times and more what the land warrant would bring. Those he would never sell. Lewis had told Eustace that he would be departing in a week, but it actually took him 3 weeks to get going. He packed all his belongings, including the journals, which had been continuously in his possession since the end of the expedition. He told Clark he would go to Philadelphia to get the publication process started. His baggage contained, among many other items, a sea otter skin, a pair of red slippers, a silver tumbler, a tomahawk, 5 vests, 2 pairs of pantaloons, 1 pair of black silk breeches, 2 cotton shirts, 1 flannel shirt, 2 pairs of cotton stockings, 3 pairs of silk stockings, a bundle of medicines, a broadcloth coat, a pistol case, 3 knives, a sword, a pike blade with a broken shaft, his espontoon, and all his official papers. He got off on September 4th. Some days after Lewis left St. Louis, one of the land commissioners in the territory, Clement Penrose, accused Bates of being responsible for the mental derangement of the governor, which Penrose said was due to the barbarous conduct of the secretary. Bates confronted Penrose after a meeting of the Board of Commissioners. He charged Penrose with spreading slanders against him and said, "I pledge my word of honor that if you ever again bark at my heels, I will spurn you like a puppy." Later that day, he wrote Penrose a record of the conversation. "You said that I have been and am the enemy of the governor, and that I would be very willing to fill that office myself. I told you this morning that it was false, and I repeat that it is an impudent stupidity in you to persist in the assertion. In return for the personal allusions with which you have honored me, I tender to you my most hearty contempt." In another letter that week, Bates wrote that all feeling minds are indifferent.